Yeah, so good. I'm just before lunch. Perfect. And apparently I anticipated well. I can't see with all my glasses. No. Sorry, I need my glasses here. What? Okay. So anyway, so do we live in a quantum world, a new twist? So I thought this would be fun for this particular audience in quantum control. And this question is not that biology doesn't have quantum objects that have been optimized to absorb light. So clearly, rules of quantum mechanics are obeyed. The question I'm posing here, which I think is interesting, one of the most wonderful manifestations of quantum mechanics, is the phase. So what I'm referring to here, is it conceivable, nature knowing about quantum effects, that it puts correlations into the system, long-lived correlations, coherences, that can undergo constructive interference to enhance the functionality, whatever that functionality is? That's the question. And so, again, this quip here about a new twist, we're gonna use a biological test object, which is the primary step in vision, which is one of the most highly optimized biological functions there is. It's been with us for a very long time, and it involves a twist. And at the end, so there are a few people here who have heard me give effectively this exact same talk at CEFED. So I will tell you there's a surprise ending now, so we have some new results. So it won't be a completely, you can go to sleep now for the next, you know, 25 minutes or so. Anyway, the people who deserve credit, Valentin Prokhorenko, who did a lot of this work, and Lena Brown, I want to point out. And then we had a collaboration, I'm going to talk about this as a surprise ending, with Massimo Vellucci and Samar Gomez. And at the end, if people are interested, for the coherent control people, we've now been able to get atomic resolved motions with 0.001 angstrom resolution and 200 femtosecond time resolution for large objects. So you can kind of start thinking about coherent control. We actually watch at the atomic level the light-matter interaction. So I know I'm going to run out of time, but if anybody asks, I can show you a nice movie where we got the first movie of how complex systems reduce down to a few key coordinates. We see that at the atomic level. Okay, so in the beginning, I like this joke, this is from Valentin, there was only let there be light, and then the thing that started all of life, of course, are these plants that created oxygen and so forth, and they've been around for a long, long time, and they use light as one of the reagents to impart their functionality. Right? So if you think about a biological test object to look at this, you think about the timescales you're fighting, right? So you're always talking about electronic decoherence and vibrational decoherence, which we've talked about a lot. You need to go to the optical domain to access the timescales, and so you need a light-activated biological process to test this. And fortunately for us, this is the all-time champion. This is the one that should be most highly optimized if you had to pick one. Okay. Now, quantum coherence in biology has a long history, and Paul was saying it repeats itself every 40 years. I have to tell you that I first got exposed to this conundrum when I was a first-year student, when I took philosophy, and I had a thesis to critique. It was on free will versus determinism, right? And the argument in the thesis I had to read was that it was written in the late 1920s, and some philosopher just discovered the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and everything basically boiled down to if there's, you know, thinking involves electrons, and if electrons are uncertain, therefore we have free will. This is one of the first examples of where this bastardization of a fundamental limitation of measuring wave properties came to my understanding. But every once in a while, you'll see another rendition of these kind of conundrums, and when you look at them and peel them back a little bit, there's always a length scale and a time scale associated with the underlying quantum phenomena that's purported, right? So what they don't talk about is what's the length scale of the coherence? There's an underlying wavelength associated with this matter wave that's relevant. If the wavelength isn't on the same length scale as the phenomena, it's not going to be important, right? If it's the old baseball, you know, what's the de Broglie wavelength of a baseball to a batter? It doesn't matter if it's too small, right? But the other property is the coherence time. You know, how long does a coherence particularly persist in the system? So these are the things that aren't typically discussed. And I'll tell you, I have a number of biological colleagues that still talk to me, but they don't want their students to even learn about quantum mechanics to mucky up their minds. And you can kind of understand their point, right? If you sort of calculate the de Broglie wavelength of a protein at room temperature, it's like, you know, 10 to the minus 15 meters. It's completely irrelevant to the length scales of biological processes. But I want to just pull back a little bit from that knee-jerk reflex on whether quantum effects play any possible role in optimizing biological functions, which is sort of what I'm trying to address. Is it possible? Right? So you have to go back and think, what do we mean when we have a living system? Right? So I'm going to invoke the Horowitz definition of a living system. I ask the students this often if they're living or not. So the first criteria is you have to be self-replicating. Okay, some of us think we can do that. The second criteria is you have to be mutable. And this is where a lot of students and maybe people listening to me right now are falling asleep. You're no longer responding to stimuli. It's not mutations. Mutations are corrections to long-term environmental fluctuations. You have to respond to be able to get nourishment and replicate. The third property, and this is the key one, is the system has to be catalytic. And if you compare a homogeneous system to one that self-assembles, which we call a living system, you can have turnover, catalytic turnover rates that are something like 10 to the 20 orders of magnitude faster than a homogeneous system. So the system is wired up in a way to do things in a special way. Well, how does it do that? The central tenet of biology is that the protein structure, whatever it is highly optimized to lower the barrier height. It's controlling the barrier height or passage through the transition state region, right? And that's one of the keys, all right? So now let's examine, this is the central tenet of biology that connects, chemistry drives biology, and this is the connection point, right? And so now let's think about the corresponding length and time scales. Just think if it's possible, right? So what's the length scale? So it's not the whole protein that's moving during these chemical reactions, it's more localized process. So now you ask the question, what's the de Broglie wavelength of a carbon atom moving at the speed of sound, which is typical transition state velocities, right? That's 0.3 angstroms, right? The net RMS motion of the structure change I'm going to tell you about is 0.1. So the length scale of the underlying matter wave is comparable to the actual biologically relevant motions that impart functionality on this system, right? So now we have to talk about the time scales. So we've heard a lot about time scales. We have an electronic decoherence time scale. We know from a lot of different measurements that's between 10 to 100 femtoseconds at room temperature. But the vibrational decoherence time scales are more on the 100 femtosecond to 1 picosecond time scales. And it's the vibrations, the nuclear motions that have to occur to get you from one structure to another. So that's roughly 100 femtoseconds to picoseconds, right? What's the time scale of barrier crossing transition state passage? You can argue about this a little bit, but it's on the order of 100 femtoseconds. So the time scale is actually consistent. So there is a prospect that you could have important quantum interference effects at transition state crossing points. And the question boils down to, does a coherence last long enough? Are the correlations imposed in the system that could actually lead to any kind of enhanced crossing? And so, you know, we were thinking about this, my group, for a long, long time to try and put an end to this. And this is the question, how has nature evolved to exploit phase? And what we're talking about effectively here is what's the coherence of a wave property? You're talking about a matter wave. So you have to make some kind, if you want to measure coherence of a wave, you have to make some kind of interferometer. And me being in Toronto and Paul Brimmer being there, of course, we go with the coherent control, which is like it's an interferometer. You're looking at interference on the molecular frame and try to see how this molecule affects its response by changes in how you prepare the state and the phase. That's the idea. And I just want to give you a nice kind of model, a quip, if you will, to think about this, because I think it's important to think of some wave property that at least states whether this is even possible. So let me just give you a classic analogy that I was thinking through whether I should even do this experiment or not. So imagine I have a target state, which is to move a surfer to shore, and I have two possible potential energy surfaces, right? So I have a potential energy surface off of England with a very rough periodic potential, and I have a bias, a wind coming in. And you can kind of imagine these Dickinsonian huge waves with a very short coherence time. You drop your surfer in, what happens? Crashes. He undergoes a diffusive walk to shore, a pretty bouncy ride, but he gets there eventually. But that's a sort of a drunken sailor with a bias type of motion. Now take the same bias, same wind, go to Hawaii, where you now have a naturally evolved potential energy surface. Now you get very long-lived coherences. You drop your surfer, poof, over he goes. That's the question. What do these potential energy surfaces look like in proteins, and do they have correlation lengths and time scales that would allow those kind of interferences to happen? And so that's what we're going to take a look at. And in the end, I'm not going to be able to answer the question, basically. I'm going to say it's a definite maybe, to spoil the suspense. OK. So again, David gave you a bit of discussion on this. All I want to make is one point. How finely tuned up can biology be, or is it? Do we already know? So just imagine you're Mother Nature, and you're trying to harvest the sunlight, and you've got these organic things you have to deal with, right? You just take a simple particle in a box type picture, and you say, how big does an organic molecule have to be to match the maximum power point in the solar energy spectrum? You can get within very, very accurate with even a simple particle in a box problem. The molecule should be about this big, right? These porphyrins in them. Turns out these molecules, by virtue of their size, have inherently around 200 wave number modes. These modes come up everywhere, right? We see them in systems that aren't evolutionarily optimized. They just happen to absorb light in the visible spectrum, right? The thing you should know about these molecules, if you leave them all by themselves, they'll form dimers, and the lifetime of these states is 100 femtoseconds. And there are other types of light harvesting systems that have very fast non-radiative relaxation processes, retinal being one of them, that have 100 femtosecond relaxation processes. So Mother Nature had to figure out a way to arrange these things to prevent, that's the first order, prevent dimerization, and also to have at least the initial process be fast enough to beat these very fast non-radiative relaxation processes when you have these floppy molecules that have lots of high density vibrational states that lead to fast non-radiation decay. So my point is that nature, if you sort of think about it, has to be optimized into the picosecond, sub-picosecond timescale to avoid some serious entropic losses. Okay, so now we look at vision, which is the system we're going to look at. Oh, great. My wife will call. It happened once. So anyway, I was really inspired by this paper by Rich Matthews and Chuck Shank back in 94, where they looked at retinal and they did a femtosecond experiment, and they saw these coherent oscillations around 200 wave numbers in what looked to be the product state. And the argument was that this vision process occurs at coherently, right? And I thought about that experiment. It's interesting, but you can't tell whether the oscillations you see are actual modes involved with the isomerization coordinate, just happen to be spectator modes. You have a fast reaction, they get displaced in the product. So anyway, we wanted to do this experiment and show, by changing the phase of this state preparation, that we could lead interference and really prove this. But of course, you have to do this under weak field control. Otherwise, if you do it in strong field control, you're mixing lots of electronic states that have nothing to do with the optimized function, and you aren't really learning about the system response. And so the idea is, could we do this experiment under weak field control conditions? And then the other thing, just to let you know, is we've done rhodopsin. I'm not going to talk about rhodopsin. We've actually done it. But we did done most of the work on bacterial rhodopsin. Why? Because you can grow bugs and harvest lots of this stuff. To do these experiments, you need lots of material. Rhodopsin, and I wasn't willing to kill hundreds of cows for the sake of science. So we use bugs. We're pretty rough with them. It's OK. The cycle for this has been very well worked out. There have been lots of experiments done that have fully characterized the dynamics for this particular process. The thing you should know that for this, in the rhodopsin case, it's a C11-C12 isomerization cis to trans. In this particular molecule, it's a trans to cis isomerization, which occurs at the C13-C14 bond, right? This looks like a dramatic change, but you have to actually look at the structure. This is my point I want to make. It's actually a fairly subtle, people call it a kind of hula twist motion. There are very small motions that lead to a net change in the charge that ultimately leads to proton translocation and stimulus of your eye, right? And the thing that's interesting about this molecule, some things I have to point out. If you take retinol, this is the orange stuff in carrots that your mom tells you you should eat for your eyes, which she's right. If you take this and put it in water, if you think, again, particle in the box picture, you put a node in the wave function in excited state, if you're at a higher level. That node simply can be any one of these double bonds. That leads from a double bond to a single bond. It leads to a bond elongation or a softening, and that'll allow rotation around any one of these bonds. And if you think about it, you get something like 32 different possible photoisomers, and you see every single one for retinal in water, right? If you take the same molecule, embedded in this structure, these 7 trans helical membrane structures, the amazing thing is you only get one photo product. It happens exactly at the C13-C14. In the liquid case, retinal water, the quantum yields are only about 1 to 2% for any photo product. You get one photoproduct, and the quantum yield for this is 65%. It's really quite remarkable. So there's a lot of engineering that's happening in that protein that we're trying to figure out, and there'll be some lessons on how to actually optimize reaction coordinates, I think. But one point I want to make is that when you think about these transition state crossings, just to give you an idea of the dynamics that must necessarily be involved, imagine you're a quantum mechanic, and you want to stick your hands inside this thing and have it undergo that isomerization along the C13 to C14 bond. If you think about it, my hands don't work so well for trans to cis. Let's start cis and we'll go trans. In order for this to happen, I have to have a node, so I got a bond elongation. That'll lead to larger, because now you have you reduce the barrier to this fluctuation. You get larger RMS motions along the torsional coordinate, and that, so it's this softening and this motion that's involved with the reaction. There's a power spectrum, a reaction power spectrum we haven't talked about before, but you sort of think about it, there's a power spectrum associated with that reaction coordinate. In the case of how does the system take the input energy in and optimize the direction of that into the reaction power spectrum? Okay, so there's been some other work done on this by other people, so it's not more or less, there's work by Gustav Gerber's group and Marcus Mutzkus, I should point out. These were done more in the high excitation limit, but there have also been other tests for biological systems, and there's been some control being seen. So I have to point out that this was not without a fight. So when you do these things in the weak field, there was this paper by Pauls. For example, if you're talking about a closed quantum system, and you try to do coherent control in a closed quantum system, and you define the target state to be an eigenstate, there's only one way to get to an eigenstate. There's not a double slip. There's no interfering pathway. So they showed you don't get control. It's impossible. So I just want to point that out because there was a lot of discussion on this point. When you go to another case of bichromatic control, again, closed quantum system, then what they showed was, in fact, you can get control, which is linear, right? So this is weak field control for bichromatic, because there are two different ways, depending on the phase relationship between E1 and E2, you can imagine some interference in how you prepare this state here, okay? The problem with that is, how do you prepare the relative phase of E2 and E1? You'd have to bring in a separate way of preparing it, so formally this would be a nonlinear experiment. It wouldn't be weak field control in the sort of one photon limit picture. But now what I just want to point out, if you turn this around and you talk about a molecule in an open quantum system where now this has got dynamics that are involved, right? And you imagine you excite a system and you prepare through the Frank-Hanon or some vibrational overlap that you change the superposition state, you can imagine now where you can have interference effects that depend on how the phase relationship of the various vibrational modes you prepare as you launch this wave packet and whatever this potential energy surface looks like. And they will interfere at this conic intersection, which looks like basically a beam splitter interferometer. And so this was the idea we had, that you could imagine launching the system so you get interference at this point, so you get more or less transmission through that barrier. So that's the idea for weak field control for this particular system in an open quantum system. And so this point looks, it's interesting that there's some fundamental differences for coherent control in closed and open quantum systems. Okay, so this is an experiment we did. You come in with a short laser pulse, you can shape it, monkeys and typewriters, then you probe how much stuff you have, right? And the key thing we did, because you're doing weak field control, if you end up putting the spectrum off where there's not much absorption, of course you don't get much form, so you have to do this under actinic control, and that was the thing we did, and we spent a lot of time doing this with numerous types of methods of probing to make sure we were under constant absorption conditions. Okay, so you have to do this, there's small changes, so it has to be done. You spend a lot of time on the laser system, and this is Valton, who's the most important piece of the equipment. Just to show you what this looks like, this is a toy problem where we just looked at population transfer for rhodamine 101, which absorbs exactly the same window as the bacteriodopsin. And we just really were very careful to try to do random phase and amplitude, because we're doing both amplitude and phase shaping. And what we found for this particular system, you're just asking, can I get more or less excited states by looking at the bleach? We always see this thing latch. I'm just going to stop it. We always see it latch to some spectral interference like this, and that spectral interference matches pretty well the time-dependent Frank Condon factor that we see in this molecule that modulates the transition probability. So we pick a pole shape that actually resonantly matches the fluctuations in that molecule to get more transfer. So this was a toy problem we did. And then we went in to do the bacterial rhodopsin, the real problem. And the current pictures are there are two possible models. One is this two-state model, and the one I think is more accepted is where you have a small barrier in the excited state potential because you can see leakage over here with delayed fluorescence. But it doesn't matter which potential you use. The idea is how you prepare it and what happens to this conical intersection that could lead to interference effects, give you more or less transmission. Okay, so we did the background experiments, and I'm running out of time already. And I want to just say that we were able to basically get the expected dynamics for the system. Everything was self-consistent, which is very well worked out by many other paper work. And this is the important difference in absorption between the trans and cis. And so what we do is we park our absorption rate here at the maximum of the difference to tell whether we get more or less stuff. So we come in, prepare the state, and then we look at some time delay later, after the system's calmed down, where there aren't rapid changes happening. So we simply ask, when the system undergoes this reaction in an open quantum system, it's the system that makes a measurement and creates the cis for state, right? So we're going to look where we don't have rapid changes in the absorption from other relaxation pathways, and we say, do we have more or less of this stuff? Okay, and 630 is the key wavelength. Okay. So we did this, and we go through again this monkeys and typewriters thing. And again, this could have been absolutely anything, but the pulse latched, and there's errors. We do this, we ran this over and over again. We always see roughly the same kind of spectral interference here. There are shifts of a few nanometers, but basically you have this pile up on the blue and this over here in the red. And this spectral interference, by the way, corresponds exactly to this torsional mode that we know that's involved with that reaction coordinate, right? So again, it could have been anything. In addition, the pulse shape could have been any temporal profile, but it ended up being roughly the time the system takes to traverse that to the conical intersection, about 400 femtoseconds, right? And so you sort of think, you take slices of this Wigner plot of what this complex pulse that we created looks like, you have these oscillations in the electric field amplitude that match this torsional mode and overtones, right? And so you sort of think, again, with this kid in a swing type picture, if you come in with resonance with this, you'll get a bigger displacement for this key reaction mode, so you more efficiently drive that mode that's known to be involved with the reaction. Okay, we do the anti-optimal pulse shape, and again, we see this kind of interference again. There's small differences, but basically we recover this virtually every time, and we see an effect of about 20%. Now when you analyze that pulse, you find that it's sort of like a quarter phase. It's 155 wave numbers. It's like you're pushing a kid in a swing, and then you do a dirty trick, and you move in half a period and push, right? So this is sort of the kind of thing we see, and its pulse is pretty much all in the center, and then there's one kick to try to suppress it, right? So we see control. We showed it was phase dependent, so now we leave the spectrum identical, and we just simply change the phase. The dominant term is the amplitude shaping, but we see about a 7% in the phase. And not to get into too much, but we've also done a full population. We do a full spectral analysis, which you can do. And we have all the information there. We can use decay-associated spectrum and analyze the different pulse shapes. And forget that. And what you see for the transmitted pulse, you get this 470 femtosecond pulse, the dynamics that you expect for that initial J-intermediate formation. And if you go to the optimal pulse, it's 490. OK, it's not much different. But if you go to the anti-optimal, you see a clear difference in the dynamics. So we're still seeing relatively good yields, but we are affecting the dynamics and how this thing is moving along the excited state, depending on which phase relationship we have for the pulse. OK. So basically, I'm just going to cut to the chase. From theory, there was some work from Victor Batista's group that showed that this motion through the conical intersection is very sensitive to how you prepare the pulses. There was a problem with this theory in that they used two Gaussians and there was changes in the spectrum that they didn't take into account. But what I want to show you is that motion of this vibrational wave pack you're creating is that the transmission through the conical intersection is quite sensitive to the phase. And this is what we're seeing. They were predicting something like 30%, and we saw up to 20. Okay. So it seems like that the main point here is that the coherence, in order for us to see this kind of interference effect, the coherence is actually conserved long enough along the reaction cord. That was the thing that I thought was surprising, because you imagine all the possible degrees of freedom, you couldn't possibly see these kind of interfacts in a system like this. Okay, so I'm not going to go through to the strong field control case, which I was going to, but basically, as of 2009, we control a biological function. There are fundamental differences between weak field control and closed and open quantum systems. The type of structure we see matches what you expect, again, for this power spectrum for the reaction. And my conclusion here is the coherence is conserved. We don't know, I can't do life again without quantum mechanics, so I can't prove that they're using it. But I can show you that proteins can be taught to surf, with my surf analogy. Right? So now I'm going to go, we did the strong field, so if people want to know about that story, I can tell you. This is the new stuff. And so since David talked about 2D, I can tell you that when you look at excitonically split systems, when you see electronic states in two-dimensional spectrum, you see these off diagonals. That's the key pattern I just want to show you. So these are new results. You also will have these with vibronic couplings. That was the point that was brought across by David. Right? So we went and we looked at a model system, and we could characterize it, and I'm not going to go into the details, and show that the long-lived electronic coherence of their FMO are probably not correct. The key point I want to show you is that those off diagonals are representative of strongly coupled two strongly coupled electronic surfaces. Now, in bacteriorhodopsin, it's a single molecule, and we were just expecting to look two-dimensionally. When we prepare the system and look how that wave function evolves, where we have perfect state registration, we're tagging a particular quantum state and look with 2D spectroscopy to see what's going on. So this is the experiment we did, and I'm just showing you the spectrum of the trans and cis, not the difference, so you can keep track of the peak position of the absorption for the cis. We do the 2D spectrum, okay, now that David gave a little bit of tutorial in it. And you see a clear vibronic structure, this hydrogen on a plane type motion. But this is the key thing I want to show you. At 10 femtoseconds, we see this off diagonal component as if this was an excitonic, like two electronic states that were mixed. This is much larger than anything we've seen in a molecule. Whenever you do a molecule, you see any kind of vibrational beats, they're very small, right? And so we saw this extraordinarily strong feature, and it turns out when you look, this is the excitation, and you read, this is exactly where the cis photoproduct should be, right? It's not an excited state absorption. This is very unusual. And again, these are new results. So when you look and you now analyze that particular part of the spectrum, look at these. These are extremely large amplitude. These aren't the very small amplitude effects that people see in FMO. These are huge. And you know, you see this appearance of what looks to be the cis photoproduct that oscillates in and out of phase. And if you look at a different vibrational peak, you can start to see other vibrational modes. And when you analyze these, and you just look at those vibrational periods, we can get, this was the interesting thing, we see the CC stretch, C-double-one stretch, CC stretch. This is this bond elongation I was talking about. We see the HOP, which leads to a pyramidalization that's involved with this hula twist motion. And we see the low frequency torsion, right? And so this, to me, when I saw that, here's the problem. This is the key point I want to make. As a chemist, you start with a reactant surface, and you end up over in the product, and there's a barrier. And so we're always trying to connect equilibrium fluctuations to far from equilibrium fluctuations. And when you draw a potential energy surface like this, especially for the bacteriorhodopsin, what you're saying are these two electronic surfaces are orthogonal, and they only meet at that conical intersection. That's the current picture we have. What this showed, and that's supposed to take 400 femtoseconds, what this showed is right within 10 femtoseconds, we're already seeing extraordinary vibrational non-adiabatic mixing. There's huge shifts in the spectrum in the emitted polarization that we're seeing in the 2D. Okay, so I told Massimo this story. So rather than like this, the surface is really vibrationally coupled for even high frequency modes. So it's like this, like a butterfly. It's not like this. There's couplings everywhere, right? This makes it very interesting to think about. I think it has some consequences for our control experiments. So Massimo did this. He's an expert on rhodopsin. He cut away everything and left this unit here, which contains most of the physics. He calculated the HOP mode, and this is just looking at, this takes a thermal distribution isolates the various vibrations and recalculates electronic structure, letting them thermally fluctuate, and calculates the what's called the derivative coupling, which is related to non-adiabatic mixing between electronic surfaces. These are motions parallel between the S1 and S0 surface. Okay? Here's the big surprise. That's me. Okay, so this is this bond BLA's bond length elongation we see. You see this oscillation? This is exactly what we see in the experiment. They go back, this period here, 12 femtoseconds, you see? He recovers. And the thing you need to appreciate here when you're looking at these derivative couplings is the band gap. It's very strongly modulating the band gap. So that bond elongation that's putting the node where it needs to be is modulating the S1, S0 electronic surface by as much as 30%. And I'm out of time, and I think I got the main message home. So these are huge non-adiabatic couplings. The surface is not at a particular vibrational coordinate that defines the conical intersection. You're mixing, and it looks like the mode you need to put in the reaction coordinate, the potential energy surface, has been modified by the protein to place the Frank-Condon factors. So you deliberately bias the system, and the initial bond elongation is already in a way now non-anharmonically coupled. It's already trapped. And this finally explains why bacterial rhodopsin has a 65% quantum yield, even though it's a factor of 3 slower than rhodopsin. Okay, so I just go through. This is the current model that Massimo's come up with. It's not just one surface. There are multiple mixings and times of interaction that allow this system to find the isomerization coordinate. Okay, so the main conclusion I'm trying to get across here, 2 points. The coherence, and I talked about the conundrum here, is conserved because the state's rapidly evolving, but it's involving the molecule itself. The bath is not so important on these timescales. And the main thing, and I guess this is kind of echoing what David was also saying, nature looks like she's really mastered vibrational coherences, and that's the key. Electronic coherences, I was going to give you a song and dance about how the long-lived electronic coherences we've shown can't be right. But the vibrational, long-lived vibrational coherences are in fact the actual modes, when you think about it, that have to do the work in the first place, and those ones are conserved. And so now it's a question of what does that potential energy surface really look like, and what kind of fluctuation can lead to interference effects that might optimize function. So it's a similar kind of question with energy transfer, but now this is where you're actually doing work on the surroundings. You're actually moving charge and storing it. So on that note, I'll stop, and thanks for your attention.
This is a little bit of a question about whether that initial direction in that first 10 femtoseconds is really sort of an adiabatic initial direction, or whether it's established by, you know, this Pachucus force, which tends to push you towards a conical intersection, if you've run into that. And I was wondering.
Yeah, I don't know the Pachucus force.
Okay.
I would say you could call it adiabatic coupling, except for the fact that that coordinate is strongly modulating the electronic gap. And then when you look at and this is Massimo, and I haven't had a chance to go through the theory, this is brand new, but this derivative vector coupling that he calculates, that's mixing, and so I would say that's non-adiabatic. It's fast, but it's non-adiabatic. It's interesting, you're already getting distortion. And so the picture we have of trapped intermediates at you know, 200 femtoseconds isn't right. There's already distortion that's important. It's already localized. I didn't go through the whole song and the whole picture, but the initial picture is a bond elongation, so it's not a charge transfer. That's the first 10 to 50 femtoseconds, but it's a distortion. It's not coming back. It's already kind of trapped along the proper seam for the reaction coordinate. And then the next motion, the next sampling of the electronic surface, separates the charge, and then it's really gone. I mean, that's what the charge you need. The electron has to go from the nitrogen to that carbon, and that's what leads to the proton translocation step.
Yeah, I don't want to harp on this too much, but I just want to once again close the loop between this and the discussion earlier this morning about what happens when you absorb incoherent light, which of course is what's happening when your eye absorbs sunlight,
right,
or ordinary light. And what your vision of the process is in that case, you know, obviously this is very different from the photosynthetic case. There's a single chromophore involved, but the issue of whether there is, of what the nature is of the motion and whether you can describe its dynamics in a simple way like this, which of course they're used to doing.
So the thing you can now see is the molecule itself is strongly coupling electronic surfaces, right? So I have an incoherent source coming in, but the Frank Conant factors, the transition probability, is weighted by the actual nuclear positions in a very strong,
absolutely
strong
sure,
way.
Sure.
Right. And so even if I have an incoherent source, it's the system is going to preferentially prepare motions that have the right relationship to steer it along that reaction course.
For sure, it's surely going to go in the right direction.
Yeah.
That's for sure. My only question is how you view that dynamically.
Dynamically, as you're preparing, so when the light's coming in, so
incoherent.
In Paul's picture, as I can, Paul will disagree with me.
This is the key part of what I'm asking is what happens when we're talking about incoherent light.
Yeah. So in Paul's picture, I have a very weak source that's on, and these couplings are present, and as you're preparing, you're starting to create this in his, as I understand, stationary state. But the final picture in terms of cis-trans relationship in the quantum yield would be the same. Right. So this state that you're creating in superposition has inherent coherences. The coherences mix the electronic surfaces. And so as this incoherent light is preparing this more stationary state, the final state description would be the same. And so there are coherences involved that change the correlation length of the fluctuations that are being prepared by the light that lead to a net enhancement with the final product state. But Paul will. Oh, okay.
I'm wondering about the temporal resolution of your measurements, because you showed that you have already your first interesting changes in the signal,
yeah.
10 femtoseconds after
zero. Yeah, the pulses, we could get the pulses down to about 4 femtoseconds. I think with the white light, we could actually reconstruct the instrument response function was 10. So, and the signal noise was quite good. So we have a few femtosecond time resolution.
So you would exclude that even faster dynamics could really be there, but are not being seen due to limited resolution?
I was really pleased we caught the C double bond stretch. That's about as fast as it gets.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there may be some other things we missed, but that took us a lot of work to properly manage the dispersion, the white light, and then in the excitation, how we did that. But yeah.
So let me just answer Keith's question with respect to the cis-trans isomerization or trans-cis isomerization from the incoherent perspective. So Duane basically said it almost the way I would say it, but there's an additional piece, which I've already answered in the question David Tanner asked before. So the key is that after this initial coherent transient and you create these stationary states, if you just look at the character of the stationary states and you ask, projecting onto the geometry I call cis, or projecting onto the geometry I call trans, of the stationary state, do I get, for example, the right quantum yield? And the answer is yes. The stationary state contains all of the information. So from my point of view, there's no dynamical flow from the cis to the trans. There's just creation of that state, increasing that state as the light is on, because the light is just pumping more. And if you happen to look to see how much trans you have, then you'll see you have more trans, but that's because the entire stationary state, cis and trans, are both increasing in population. You still will get a stationary state after a short occurrence. Can I just add one thing, Martin? So I just want to say that these are great experiments. I don't have to tell you, but I spent a lot of time wondering about this cis-trans stuff. And just recently, we managed to successfully show in a fully quantum calculation of a 24-mode retinal model phase control in the cis-trans isomerization of retinal. So I think I'm very happy to have done that sort of confirmation.
Oh, wait, I'm here. Let me show you my movie.
Yeah, right. Okay, so thanks everybody. Thanks all the speakers and the recovery.